Welcome to the Blockchain DNA Podcast. This show brings you the latest in blockchain technology and global developments in business and fintech. Presented by Metaverse DNA.
DNA, the Metaverse Dual Chain Network Architecture.
Hi, I'm Alex Lightman. This is the Lightman Report, and we're going to talk about part two of loans and lending, past, present, and future. So loans are part of our lifestyle. Young people usually spend all the money they have. Mature people try to make savings and pay the loans that they had off. In comparison with boomers who try to keep saving, borrowing has become a part of the lifestyle of millennials. Easy access to credit is making millennials borrow more than previous generations. 64% of demand for credit is from younger millennials, individuals between 21 and 30 years of age, while demand from older millennials is only 36% of the total, which shows that more individuals who just entered the workforce are opting for these new digital short-term loans for cars, education especially. And we'll see those numbers in a second. Lending is a really big business. Basically, banks lend money to customers at a higher rate than they pay to depositors or than they themselves borrow it at. The difference is known as the margin or the turn. It's kept by the bank. If a bank pays 1% interest on deposits, they may charge 6% interest on loans. Credit cards carry one of the most profitable types of lending, and interest rates can be 25-30% on some credit cards. The lending market before coronavirus. The loan market provides fundings for U.S. corporations and pays investors an interest rate often tied to the LIBOR, or London Interbank Offered Rate, for the privilege of borrowing. And it was just a market of about $500 billion in December 2010, which is just, you know, less than 10 years ago. And the average loan yields bounced back from a low of 62.8 during the financial crisis, but we're still at about 96.61. And if we look ahead to December of last year, the size of the leveraged loan market has doubled to $1.2 trillion. And we see this massive explosion of the loan market growing at a 123 compound annual growth rate from 2010 to 2014 and to a 51% compound annual growth rate between 2014 and 2020. And we see a huge growth in China, that big green part of the column, and also a pretty big growth in the United States with smaller growth in Australia and the UK. So we have this endless emission of credit and debt accumulation, and that's turned into a threat of the world economy. And fiscal stimulus in advanced economies has led to record levels of public debt. And it's combined with the current recession, some say depression, may create a currency and banking crisis. So this combined with the current recession may create a currency and banking crisis, might even result in changing of the reserve currency status of the U.S. dollar. And this can trigger a longer recession or even a depression in the global economy. And we can see that debt as a percentage of GDP has increased from about 70% in 2002 to well over 100% in the advanced economies. And while it's gone down in the emerging and developed economies because they've been sending in more money, basically they've been getting less credit and they're still having to pay it back. And they pay it back in loans to China through ports and harbors and mineral rights and so on. We've hit a new peak in consumer debt. Total U.S. consumer debt levels are higher than in 2008, which was the previous peak, and they're hitting pretty high numbers now, though Americans have really doubled down on their savings rates to the extent that they can save, employed Americans at least. What we're going to see in the future is the increased digitalization or digitization of lending. Digital lending is a relatively new and emerging area in the field of lending, and lending through digital platforms gained momentum as a result of employing new technologies, new credit scoring algorithms, and a more inclusive approach. Basically, more people can get loans. Governments often subsidize that. Banks and other financial institutions have already implemented this model, and basically, soon it'll replace traditional lending. over the 5 years from 2019, peer-to-peer lending platforms have evolved from startups to an industry worth over $2 billion. And if you look at the volume of different fintech companies, basically if you start with Q1 2016 is 100, you see massive growth in Europe, like 300% of that. And Australia and New Zealand have grown somewhat. United States, huge growth in China, and somewhat growth in United Kingdom. We also have the global volume of new fintech credit. We see a huge growth in Asia Pacific, some growth in the Americas, and a relatively small amount of growth in the European, Middle East, and Africa. And this is global fintech credit per capita. And are we going to see the end of payday loans? A traditional payday loan is incredibly expensive for borrowers and consumers and voters. Many of these people are voters because they're increasingly aware of how dangerous these products can be. But they won't be regulated out of existence. They'll be outcompeted by innovative products that meet the same needs at a much lower cost to the borrower. It's tough to make money off a low dollar loan because it costs so much to originate and underwrite any type of loan. And it costs so much to deal with the regulations. So just deal with any banking customer, there's $200 per bank customer just to deal with compliance costs. So you need to make a profit of more than $200. But today, there's so much data available from payroll services and employers that you can automate these loans easily, and you can make low-cost, low-dollar loans a real possibility because you can automate all the information about whether you should make the loan or not. Also, there's a rise of ethical lending and cooperation. Lending is not just business, but it's also social action. An ethical bank can be known as a social bank, an alternative bank, a civic bank, or a sustainable bank. And it's a bank concerned with social and environmental impacts of its investments and loans. And different types of cooperative and financial organizations work in the digital era, and they lend money with low or lower than commercial interest for social purposes, or they might even give loans to people who wouldn't get them otherwise. There's also green lending and loans as the world goes towards this transition of what I expect will be nearly 100% renewable energy fueling things by 2030. That's not a guarantee, but that's something I've been predicting since 2014. And a fundamental determinant of a green loan is whether the loan proceeds will go for green projects, including related supporting expenditures such as R&D. And that's all in the financial documents. Specialized financial institutions and organizations that provide green loans will become popular soon. You'll have focus organizations. Most of that will go for solar and wind as we replace the coal, oil, natural gas, the markets for which are collapsing, so much so that we saw negative prices for oil recently. And the future is all about loans and decentralized finance. Lending is probably the most developed part of decentralized finance, and more than 1.1 billion, or about 77% of the 1.8 billion locked in DeFi for lending services. As of today, when this was made in mid-July, the number reached over 2 billion, by the way. In March 2019, this was just 313 million. So just in the last five quarters, we have about a 400% increase of DeFi, and that's about 70 to 80% DeFi lending. And finally, we're going to be seeing this regulation of DeFi lending. DeFi apps are unregulated, so they're available in all countries where you can use internet and crypto. You don't necessarily need to tell the app your name or address, but DeFi projects generally operate with any financial license. And so far, DeFi apps are flying under the radar of regulators, but it's not clear how long this will continue. If governments introduce obligatory registration as financial institutions for DeFi and require this, this could endanger the whole decentralized business model. So we'll have to see how that all works out. And in the future, we're going to see that DeFi expands the lending market. DeFi has a real chance to eat traditional finance. Crypto-backed loans are reviving peer-to-peer lending and removing third-party and reducing costs. Part of the original intent from Satoshi Nakamoto in his Halloween 2008 Bitcoin is Electronic Cash white paper that kicked off all the crypto movement. And crypto backed loans are simple. You only need to have crypto as collateral. A lot of people do, maybe 50 million or so. And you don't need to provide any personal or financial information. The loan is instant or automatic. Though, I mean, most governments require know your customer, basically KYC and anti-money laundering. This can be automated. But the growth of many different organizations, including some of the more famous exchange, happened because they didn't require KYC and AML. And they're still around. They haven't been shut down. So DeFi borrowing rates can vary from 2% to over 20% depending on the asset. And this concludes our Lightman report on the past, present, and future of lending, part two. Thank you, and I look forward to seeing you. If you like this and the content like this, please like and subscribe.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now, back to the show.
Good evening, good morning, or good afternoon, depending on the globe where you are. I want to welcome everyone to the next interview on the Lightman Report, the second part of the Lightman Report on lending. Loans are an increasingly important part of society of these days. It has become more important in everyday life. Consumer debt right now worldwide, as we saw in the Lightman report, is even higher than in 2008. How do you see, Eric, how blockchain technology can help protect us from a repetition of what happened in 2008? Because, as I said, the debts are higher than they were back then. So how can blockchain help us to protect us from what happened back then?
There are a lot of problems that we blame, that we call the subprime mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. So why, the reason for the subprime mortgage, who's to blame? A lot of people say, let's don't blame anybody. No, there are somebody to blame. So people say, oh, why are you taking out loan when you are not able to repay them? That's your problem. But no, the question should be asked, why do you want to loan somebody that are not able to afford? That's a problem too. So both parties play their own part. Now, there are a lot of files are not publicly available for everybody. You don't know what's going on there. So there's no auditing process. So I'm thinking that there are some loans can be on-chain and be transparent. Some of them, if there's no privacy issue, most of them are not. You can just hide away all the sensitive personal data. These kind of data can be put on chain. I'm not saying that you should be available to everybody to view, but at least it's immutable is very important. And everybody know it's immutable is very important. So to me, loan on chain, I'll say later on, it would be possible to be a peer-to-peer mortgage would be even better. That's my thoughts.
I know Alex is going to talk about mortgages in his next Lightman report. It's another very specific area in loans. So Alex, how do you see that, you know, with consumer debt, like you stated, even higher than in 2008, how can blockchain help us to protect us from what happened to the whole world back then?
There are three aspects to protection. There's protecting the lender, the person, so that the lender loans the money and gets it paid back. There's protecting the consumer so that there's not hidden fees and hidden language in it. And then there's protecting the regulators and the government so that you don't have a collapse of a whole sector and then the whole country goes taken down. And I think that all three of those things are very, very possible given the trillions of dollars of COVID financing that's happened. Protecting the consumer happens by, I think there should be more smart contracts that are automatically executing. And as you are doing something, it prompts you and tells you that this could be a problem later. Like, I think that you should have many, many different views of looking at repayments, but certainly you should have all fees disclosed, and there should be a very clear set of payments that you can just look at your phone and say, these are the payments that are going back in repayment. And there's no balloons. a lot of reason for the massive consumer debt are these 29% interest loans. And money at 29% interest is doubling every 2.25 years or so. It's and it's very easy for people to kind of blink and two years have gone by and then another quarter and then boom, your money is doubled. A 10,000 turns to 20, turns to 40, turns to 80. And many people can't get out of that. I don't think the average poor person can get out of a $50,000 debt. No. You have a $1.4 trillion in student loans that are there. So, and you also want to have greater awareness of somebody's repayment capacity so they don't take on too much debt. Protecting the lender has to be able to see unified credentials. So do you have a job? Do you have an income? Do you have assets? Do you have a reliable, good credit score? Do you have people who will vouch for you, cosign, and so on? And as far as the government needs to have uniform standards for reporting so that you don't have massive loans put out with all that. All this can be done with blockchain, and to have some of these stripped of the name, address, phone number, and all those kind of things that allow doxing or robbery, but just we should have a blockchain whereby we can always see forever and ever over the next 100 years, what were the criteria used, what kind of people were getting what loans, and then we can actually look in deeply. I was reading an article just last night about the debt problems of the Roman Empire before that caused it to totter and fall. And sure enough, everything that we're doing now, the Romans did before they crashed.
I think that if you look at just your remark that you can see for a very long time in the future, that would be a great thing for governments to start handling, if you ask my opinion, in repaying their debts over the future.
Well, in comparison, we have over $500 billion that's been given out, and we won't see the revelation of the identities of those people until after the election on purpose. So it's the opposite of what I'm talking about.
We also learned in your report, Alex, that the market for peer-to-peer lending is already $2 billion. It's enormous. I mean, the growth is going very fast. I think, Eric, if you look at those enormous numbers that have been mounting up over the last period of time, what do you think that the expectation is for decentralized finance in this area? Will it contribute to this growth? And how can DeFi help to boost this peer-to-peer lending situation?
I happen to put into some kind of a thought on what China recently did in terms of peer-to-peer lending. If you notice the news that for the past year or two, maybe even 3-5 years, that China has been closing down all the peer-to-peer lending companies, no matter how good are you or how bad are you, right? It's closing it down. I think the reason is it's very, very, very hard for government to actually regulate a peer-to-peer lending business. And how can you actually make sure they're being transparent or they lend to a responsible lender, or say they get money from, they borrow money from people are not really give your credit card, you know, paying this credit card 21% and getting 24% from you, right? So it's very hard for the government to regulate this industry. So they don't know how to administrate this kind of business. So they shut you down, everyone. Shut down, but it's a tragedy. I mean, it's a shame to see this once such a large industry in China is gone, right? But now, I still believe peer-to-peer lending has a huge potential. But if not in a country like China, for that matter, it's not much in U.S. or Europe at this moment. Maybe it's just for DeFi, I think. Alex, you might want to
ask. Alex, how do you see that? Is decentralized finance going to, how can it be a boost? I mean, this is a growing market with a limited capacity for smaller loans. And I would say people are less able to do an enormous mountain of paperwork within the banking system to get a minor loan, basically. peer-to-peer lending is going to be increasingly popular. We know that from, you know, the growth in the past year. How do you see that decentralized finance can boost this?
Well, I see that peer-to-peer lending is going to be more important than ever. We have in the United States more than 40 million people who filed for unemployment, and the federal component of their unemployment runs out at the end of August. So we've got another, from the time that we recorded this video, a month or so before the shit hits the fan. Excuse my language. Never actually sworn in a corporate video before. But it will get bad. It'll get real bad. And so peer-to-peer lending is one of the most important things. And I want to emphasize the importance of developing something. I hope that people will make new businesses, but there's a need for small business to have peer-to-peer lending equivalent. Small businesses account for 90% of this. And some friends of mine are actually creating something called Main Street Exchange, which is going to be doing peer-to-peer lending and setting it up for small businesses, because right now many of them are facing bankruptcy, Chapter 13 or Chapter 7 reorganization or liquidation. And what happens if the providers of 90% of the employment suddenly go through catastrophic bankruptcy? We've never experienced anything like it. So peer-to-peer lending needs to come, because banks are not going to step in. They're going to grab as much money as they can from the government, and then they're just going to hold on to it. And that's why, you know, so many banks are effectively parts, they're zombie companies that are parts of the government. And I think that peer-to-peer using crypto is going to more than double each year for the next few years. And I think that the more people doing that, the better.
Okay. I think it's a very important point as you raised there. That's the inability for, I would say, mainly access of smaller loans. I would say people are less able to work themselves through the paper machine of getting even inside the banking system, or have no access at all, that peer-to-peer lending is going to be a vital point for economic growth. Without it, there is no possibility to grow. So another aspect, Eric, that is increasingly popular over the last couple of years is the ethical aspect of loaning. That we actually, when we give our savings to a bank, we have no, I would say, no say in where our money goes. There are a couple of banks who advertise with green banking or ecologically responsible or certain areas they won't invest in. But I get no say in who gets the loan from my savings. I think decentralized finance in that aspect might be a development in that area as well. How do you see the possibilities for that?
Given this current situation, I see a lot of DeFi bank, they actually claim that they are green banks. I think it's too early, kind of too early. It's still, I think it's still in the utopian stage, but I really like the way they're going. Yes, it would be nice that we, as a lender, as a saver, know where our money did some good thing. It feels good. So my personal experience, it feels good that if I donate some money to charity, I know this money actually goes to some people, right? So same thing, as a saver, I'd love to see my money loaned to for a good cause. This is one. But I think it's too early. Pretty hard to do at this moment. But we're going in the right direction. And the other thing is, again, transparency. Transparency meaning why the bank loaned money to this particular person. Are there any proper documentation behind that? Is this auditable, or is it available? Or say never been tampered with? That's pretty important. I would say we're going to the right direction, but I think, you know what, we have a long, long way to go, really.
I've got a funny example of transparency, because in the Netherlands, they had a support program. If you could prove that you had a real, you know, a missing hole in your revenue, that you could get government support to pay the wages. So you would keep these people employed and not having to fire them. What these companies didn't bank on was that the list is going to be publicly known. So for 2 weeks, they published the list of any company in the Netherlands who applied for the program publicly.
I love that too.
In some cases.
No, we should have done that. We should have published every single step of the way, including their application. So then people can say,
What you see is the company name and the amount they received last month. Every single euro in it. In some cases, that led to companies paying the money back because the public wouldn't agree with a company that wealthy, that many flesh on the bones, coming up with some, I would say, cleverly created story about them needing money. And a lot of single employed people in the Netherlands, you know, just single employment because it's the only way they can survive in the economy, didn't get anything at all because they couldn't get to the paper mill. So that list was an unexpected surprise for many companies. I must say, in our office, we went through the list to just look at some names that we knew to see if they claimed any benefits in the area.
I was doing, yes, justice is served.
Yeah. I was so happy they did that because you could exactly see who abused the system, which is, you know, led in some cases people paying the money back. That actually was the large amounts, even that people who are publicly known as being extremely wealthy, still their companies pay, you know, having been paid these benefits, that they knew it was going to cost them public image, going to cost them all sorts of things. So they rather gave the money back, which was, I think, a very good development in transparency. I think it was fair to know who was giving this money for free, because it was money given for free, just like that. Last question then posed to you as well, Alex, you know, ethical loans, ethical spending of savings. Do you see development in decentralized finance for that? Because, you know, I would love to know where my savings are going if I deposit them somewhere.
Sure. I have a friend who is a crypto person through and through. He showed me peer-to-peer lending on his phone. He's done a compound deal. So a lot of the things that I talk about here in the Lightman Report, he lives it, eats it, sleeps it, and breathes it. And with some partners, he set up a PPE bank called Social Health that is very much informed by crypto principles and uses this. So I actually know of an institution that's doing a lot of different deals with PPE, gloves, masks, surgical gowns, things like that. And it's based on crypto principles and makes use of crypto. So that's a yes. One of the things that I expect to see is that in the absence of a really good universal healthcare program for everybody, like you would have in the Netherlands, in the US, we're going to see a big emphasis on medical savings and having decentralized medical loans, people who can borrow money to pay for their medical bills or to pay into medical savings accounts and so on. And I think that these will get charitable support, foundation, trust, and government support, because the extra spending we're going to do on medicine, to put this in perspective, in the US, we spend $13,500 for every person in America on average per year. And that was before the COVID expenses. So it's going to probably
be American on average, $13,500 per person per head. That's an amazing amount.
That's a real number. So I think that we're gonna see decentralized finance, loans, savings, all the stuff we've been talking about in the Lightman Reports applied to this. And I also have a lot more to say about this, but then I would be cutting into the next one. The next Lightman Report is the past, present, and future of mortgages. And so we'll pick this up again, but there'll be specialized mortgages for low-income housing, and I'll get more into it later.
That sounds really interesting, especially from the, you know, the perspective of ethical loan, you know, peer-to-peer lending and that whole area of more responsible behavior. I want to thank you both for this insight in, you know, peer-to-peer lending, especially in the world of decentralized finance and an increasing growth in transparency on where our savings are going. I want to thank you for today. I'm looking forward to next week when we go into a really important subject for many of us, which is mortgages. Thank you so much, you both. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Blockchain DNA podcast. Make sure to visit our website and follow us on social media at DNA by Metaverse or at MVS DNA. Till next time.